The night on the whistleblowers, the mainstream media tells you that Ukraine is a shining democracy. Washington lawmakers line up at microphones to declare, "We will stand with Ukraine for as long as it takes." And anyone who raises questions about corruption is labeled as unpatriotic, or worse, a Russian sympathizer. But behind the speeches, behind the hashtags, Ukraine is facing the worst wartime political crisis, and the man at the center of it is President Zelensky's right-hand power broker. Next, we break down the corruption story the media refuses to touch and ask a simple question. How long can Washington preach virtue abroad while ignoring the rot inside Kiev? I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Whistleblowers. For nearly 3 years, Americans have been told that Ukraine is fighting a noble, flawless fight, that the country's leadership is unified, honest, and transparent. But if you ask the Ukrainians themselves who really runs the show after the president, you'll hear one name: Andriy Yermak, Zelensky's now former chief of staff, the gatekeeper, the negotiator, and the man now sitting in the middle of a corruption scandal so big even U.S. officials can't ignore it. Let's start with what happened this past November. Anti-corruption agents in Kiev launched surprise raids on Yermak's property, searching his apartment and seizing evidence connected to an ongoing investigation. Investigators didn't say what they were looking for. Yermak says he's fully cooperating, but what triggered the search? Many accuse Yermak of having knowledge of a $100 million kickback scheme tied to Ukraine's state atomic energy agency, Energoatom. A scheme that involved a massive system of laundered money, controlled contracts, and political insiders. This scandal has already cost two Ukrainian ministers their jobs, and it comes exactly when Ukraine is being pressured by the United States to make concessions to Moscow. A dangerous moment for Kiev. And the timing of these raids? It's not a coincidence. You see, this isn't some low-level graft case. Yermak is Zelensky's closest ally, his fixer, his enforcer, his foreign policy arm, and now the face of the biggest wartime scandal Ukraine has faced. The question is this: why is no one in Washington talking about it? Because if they did, the entire stand with Ukraine narrative would start to wobble. Right now, Kiev is trying to negotiate a U.S.-backed peace framework that includes painful concessions to Russia, territorial losses, military limits, and long-term demilitarization. Now the legitimacy of that process collapses if the negotiator is under a corruption investigation. And all while this is happening, Ukraine's lifeline is falling apart. That energy scandal? Well, it involved a high-level criminal network inside Energoatom, the state nuclear operator. Kickbacks of 10 to 15% on contracts. Payments blocked unless bribes were paid. State suppliers extorted for millions. Daily blackouts hammering civilians heading into winter. It's Ukraine's worst wartime political crisis, and now it appears to be growing. And still, Washington barely says a word. Cable news barely mentions it. The same lawmakers who lecture Americans about defending democracy don't seem to care that the country they're sending billions to is firing ministers weekly for corruption. But Ukrainians, they care, and they're fighting back. Ukrainians across Lvov, Odessa, and Kiev in August took to the streets in the first major anti-government protests since the full-scale invasion began. Their demand? Restore the independence of the anti-corruption agencies after Zelensky signed a law placing them under political control. Faced with public outrage, Zelensky reversed course and reinstated their autonomy. The people forced his hand. The message was clear. Ukrainians want anti-corruption reform. Their government... to quote the imaginary Greek philosopher Mediocrates, meh, not so much. And here's the part the mainstream media never tells you. Even the European Union is now warning that continued corruption puts Ukraine's membership and financial aid at risk. Hungary's foreign minister said it outright.
The president of the European Commission sends a letter to the member states to give another 100 billion euros to Ukraine. Come on, are we crazy? So there's a war mafia, a corrupt system working in Ukraine, and then the European Commission president doesn't even mention it in her letter. And instead of stopping the payments and demanding for immediate financial clearance, she wants to send another 100 billion to Ukraine. I mean, come on, this is insane. This is a scandal.
But in Washington, not a word, not a question, not a hearing, because pushing unlimited aid to Ukraine has become a kind of virtue signal, a moral branding exercise. To question anything is to be smeared. But corruption doesn't disappear just because the media ignores it. The aid doesn't become cleaner because Congress declares it patriotic. Joining me now is former U.S. Army Colonel Douglas McGregor. Colonel, you've been one of the very few voices in Washington willing to speak honestly about Ukraine, not just recently, but from the beginning. So let's start here. What does the Yermak scandal tell you about who really holds power inside Kiev, and how much of that power structure the U.S. actually understands?
Well, that's an important question, and I'm not sure I'm the right man to answer it. I'm familiar to some extent, but not in great detail. I think we have to understand there's this triangular relationship between what I would call the New York City financial community and its underlings in Washington, D.C., Zelensky, and Netanyahu. I think we need to understand that those are all well connected. The Mossad is heavily engaged in Ukraine, has been almost from the beginning, along with MI6 and the CIA. You put all those intelligence operatives together and some of the mercenary elements that are hired to go in there and protect people, and now increasingly who actually fight directly for Ukraine, and I think you get a picture of something that is not Ukrainian. These people, in many cases, are from somewhere else. Zelensky himself is Russian in origin in terms of his culture and language. He is not, strictly speaking, Ukrainian. When he got in there, it took him several months to learn to speak Ukrainian. And when I brought that up to someone in the State Department, they sort of said to me, well, yeah, that was a little embarrassing at the beginning, but we fixed it. Okay, you fixed it. I think Ukrainians at large are finally beginning to understand the extent to which they've been betrayed by a government that is not really theirs. And we remember, of course, Kolomoisky, who sponsored Zelensky and paid for all these neo-Nazi formations, all of which is bizarre, given the fact that both Kolomoisky and Zelensky are Jewish, but they've never had any trouble urging Ukrainians to don Nazi regalia and rush out and try to murder Russians. Doesn't make any sense. The whole thing, I think, has been a scam from the very beginning, and now it's falling apart, as you and I know. But one of the reasons the Russians want to take Odessa is not just because of what was done to them back in 2014 after the coup there, and they burned people alive in Odessa that were Russians. They also know that large numbers of mercenaries have come in through the Odessa port, along with arms and equipment and other things. So they want to shut that down because they keep finding more and more non-Russians, non-Ukrainians, non-Slavs showing up in Ukraine. And, you know, they're not showing them very much mercy. Ukrainians have always, from the very beginning, been treated well by the Russians. But the Russians have a great deal of difficulty dealing with these mercenaries. And they're having trouble dealing with us and others. We have Americans over there, Brits over there. It's not a good situation. It really isn't.
Colonel, how does corruption on that scale affect Ukraine's ability to fight, to govern, or even to negotiate?
Well, I think right now, I mean, Zelensky had a deal in place back in April of 2022 in Istanbul, and he was inclined to go along with it. And he was told, forget it. Boris Johnson showed up and spoke on behalf of President Biden and the United States and said, you will have the entire military arsenal of the United States and NATO behind you. We will provide you with all of the equipment and support and intelligence that you need, and you are going to prevail because Russia is weak. Russia does not have a capable force. Russia is in over its head. So whatever you do, don't sign any agreement. You're going to win this, and eventually we're going to bring down Russia. We're going to dethrone Putin. And I guess, you know, under the circumstances, you can't blame him for believing it, although, you know, frankly, I think that was a stretch from the beginning, but nevertheless, I think he chose to believe it. We know it was never true and it was never possible. But remember, the Russians went in with a small force at the beginning because their goal was not a major war. Their goal was to signal their seriousness about a neutral Ukraine. And they wanted to be sure that the Russians living inside Ukraine would be treated decently, that they could speak their language, be educated in Russian schools, and all these kinds of things. And, you know, at the time, and I remember this because I was talking to people in the Department of Defense at the time and the State Department, and they said, and I said to them, well, this should be very favorably received in Washington because ever since I showed up here, everybody wants to create diversity. Mm-hmm. Well, if you have Russians living inside Ukraine, that's diversity. Isn't that a good thing? Oh, apparently not. It was a very bad thing. And so, no, these Russians have to be brought into line. They have to be Ukrainianized. We've got to regain control of Crimea. And I looked at these people and I said, Crimea has been part of Tsarist Russia since 1776. That's as long as we've existed. Now you want this to become Ukrainian suddenly? I mean, it's sad. It's tragic. And now we hear these phony arguments on the legalistic side. Well, the Constitution prevents me from ceding any territory. Their Constitution isn't worth the paper it's printed on. He certainly hasn't abided by any of it. There's no religious freedom inside Ukraine at this point. So the whole thing is a travesty. And then you bring in Donald Trump. And Donald Trump was on the right track when he ran for office. And he said, I've got to end this. But he made the stupid mistake of saying, I can end it with a phone call. Well, I don't think there's much that you can end with a phone call. I know a lot of people have tried to, especially with girlfriends and wives. It hasn't gone very well. So I don't know why he thought he could do it, but he did. And then he got in there, suddenly discovered this is much more complex. And I think it took him a long time to understand that it was an existential question for the Russians, much as it would be for us. If we discovered that Guadalajara and northern Mexico was the center of gravity for a large and powerful 800,000-man Mexican force that was designed to cross the border and liberate sections of New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, Texas, and California, I think we would have responded far more violently and decisively than the Russians did. But the Russians were always treating these people as fellow Orthodox Slavs. And I think recently, President Putin tried to make that point when he was talking about a potential conflict with Ukraine, or excuse me, NATO. He said, look, NATO is NATO. If you're going to fight us, it's total war. What we've been waging is not total war. This is a special military operation with limited objectives. I think that has finally sunken in with President Trump. The problem is it doesn't make any difference at this point. This war is going to end on terms that Russia said, and we're effectively bystanders at best.
Doug, stay right here because we're going to take a quick break. And when we return, we continue to dig into what's happening on the battlefield between Russia and Ukraine. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're speaking with retired U.S. Army Colonel Douglas MacGregor. Colonel, Zelensky's critics say he's consolidating power and protecting his political allies. Based on the recent pattern that we've seen, the raids, the firings, the media suppression, where do you think the truth lies here? What's happening in that inner circle?
I think he's fueled up his private jet and is ready to go to Israel on a moment's notice. I think that's the truth. And he's not the only one. There are several other in his inner circle that no doubt will go to Israel with him. So I think this is over. The rest of this is theater, frankly. Everything he's doing at this point is theater. Even the reports coming out of the field from the Russian military, they're starting to capture people that have been in uniform for a week. And these people are going to surrender. They don't particularly care to be killed pointlessly. Some of them are boys, 14, 15 years old or younger, some women. And worst of all, now they're finding young boys dressing as women trying to get out and get through the lines by pretending they're not men. You know, they're not being treated badly. This is over. And the sad tragedy of all of this, what's really worse about it, is there's no sense of humanity. We don't seem to care. Americans are remote from it. I'm sure that if it had ever been put to a vote and Americans had any inkling of what they were doing, we wouldn't have gone there. I mean, most Americans can't find the places we bomb on maps.
Map, that's right.
Why would they support any of it? And of course, that's one of the reasons that you have volunteer armed forces, because you can move them about at will without fear that someone's going to intervene and stop you. Nobody's going to call from Baton Rouge or St. Louis or Kansas City and say, no, wait a minute, why are you sending my son or daughter or whomever it is to this place on the Arabian Peninsula or West Africa or somewhere else? So if you have an entirely voluntary military establishment, nobody cares. And in fact, everybody keeps asking me this over and over and over again. What does it take to get the American public to wake up and take an interest?
That's right.
I say 150 to 200 dead Americans in one day. Mm-hmm. That's about it. If you kill that man in one shot, then you'll probably get some attention. And of course, we work tirelessly to avoid that.
Ukraine recently struck two Russian oil carriers in the Black Sea. How might the city of Odessa factor into Russia's strategy to secure its Black Sea fleet? And what would that mean for Ukraine's viability as a nation?
Well, this was a very stupid move on the part of the Ukrainians, because if there had been any question in anybody's mind in Moscow about what has to happen, it's gone. Odessa is going to become Russian. They've already got special operations forces moving around the city, particularly at night, because both Kiev and Odessa are dark at night. It's black. You know, you have no energy. So people are huddled inside their homes trying to stay warm. And the Russian special ops, of course, have night vision capability. There isn't much down there in terms of Ukrainian military capability. So they're walking around the city. I think the Russians can go in pretty much anytime they want. I think they will. And they can come down very quickly from Zaporozhye. They cross the bridge up there, head south. They'll be down there in a day. And they've got the forces to do it. What they've been doing thus far is sort of cleaning up behind the front as they move forward. This is different than a normal war in the sense that if you leave pockets of crazy Ukrainians that want to fight to the bitter end, then you risk losing soldiers being shot in the back of their head or shot in their backs, period. They don't want to go through that. So, you know, you got to clean it out. So they're cleaning these things out. But they've got forces up near Chernigov in the north and forces down south near Zaporozhye, Pokrovsk, and so forth. They can move decisively when they choose to do it. Right at the moment, I'm told the temperatures are a little higher than expected, so I imagine that they'll want the ground to freeze. So they may wait a little while in order to move large forces. But they've got to take Odessa. And once Odessa falls into Russian hands, you have the original historic Ukraine. Because if you go to the maps, Ukraine never reached the Black Sea. And that whole area down by the Black Sea was under Mongol or subsequently Ottoman rule and was never Europeanized, if you will. So what you then got was a war or a campaign to drive out the Ottomans and the Tartars or the Tatars. That was won under Catherine the Great. She cleaned it out and then established what they call New Russia. New Russia was then populated with largely Russians. Some Ukrainians were brought down, but it was overwhelmingly Russian, and it has been ever since. So then the historic Ukraine that reaches from the Polish border due east to Kiev and a little bit on the other side is back where it was for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, certainly since the 13th century. So then Ukraine becomes what? Does it become a rump state that consists of whatever the Russians decide to put in there? Or do the Europeans step up? And I think the Europeans ultimately will engage. And from the very beginning, the thing that the Russians privately have said, and I've said it as well because I believe it's true, the countries on the border with Ukraine, and that's largely Poland, to some extent Lithuania, then Slovakia, Moldova, Romania, Hungary, those are the governments that have an interest in what the emerging map looks like. They should have a say in it. And I think that President Putin is very receptive to that, provided whatever comes out is not overtly hostile to Russia and is neutral.
Right.
But it's going to be a rump state of some kind. Now, I don't know. I've heard some polls talk about the possibility that there could be a confederation with Ukraine. In theory, they've already got that, but it's not real. That's a possibility. But right now, the polls have 3+ million Ukrainians in their country they want to send home. The only way that they could get them back into Ukraine is to get peace. So then you have several hundred thousand Hungarians living on the wrong side of the border. And right. This goes all the way back to World Wars I and II. You know, these are old stories. You know that from personal experience.
Oh, yes.
Europe goes through this all the time. We don't understand any of it, which is why we shouldn't have any role in it.
That's right. Borders change, and, not ours, but theirs certainly do.
And the interest in all of this is in Europe. And frankly speaking, the one interest we have and have had from the very beginning, as soon as the first shot was fired in 2014, when the Ukrainians began lobbing artillery rounds in Donetsk and Luhansk and killing civilians on the street over there, was stability and peace. That's our interest. Without stability and peace, you can't do business. If you can't do business, there's no prosperity. There's no order. So the bottom line is that's where President Trump should have focused from the beginning. But he surrounded himself with people who are what I call clever know-nothings. They know nothing about Europe. They know nothing about Ukrainians or Russians or anybody else that lives there. They have agendas that are remote from American interest, and they've been allowed to pursue those at great expense to the American people. Doug, here we are.
Looking 5 or 10 years ahead, what would be the best possible outcome for all the major players? We're talking about Ukraine, Russia, Europe, the U.S. And can Russia ever be reintegrated into a broader Western framework?
I think the opportunity to reintegrate Russia or integrate it for the first time really in history is past for the moment. I think the Russians are going to remain extremely skeptical, if not for 10 years, maybe decades. What you can do is you can begin the process of trying to rebuild trust and confidence. That will come if Russia is able to do business with us, with Germany, with other states. That's not going to happen overnight, but it needs to happen. Now, clearly, if you get non-globalist governments, in other words, nationalist governments in France and Great Britain, in Germany, and ultimately even in Poland, that'll change because it's in the national interest of those people, particularly the Germans and the Poles, the Lithuanians, Latvians, Estonians, to do business with the Russians. I mean, I know the Baltic peoples, and they're wonderful people. They just refuse to let go of what happened under Soviet occupation. That's what they live in, that nightmare, and they see the current regime in those terms. They refuse to see reality. They have to. The Germans can play a role in that. The Germans have always had enormous influence in the Baltic states, as have the Swedes. They can turn a lot of that around. But first and foremost, we have to normalize relations with Russia. If we can normalize relations with Russia in spite of the Congress, which is being bought and paid for by critical lobbies that hate Russia, not the least of which is AIPAC. It's not the only one. There are others. If we can do that, then there's a good chance that we can achieve stability and peace in Eastern Europe. But right now, that's a long shot. But at least if new governments come to power, they have a chance to move forward in that direction. Now, getting us out, and this is where I strongly agree with President Trump and always have on NATO. Let's disentangle ourselves from this mess. NATO has not made a lot of sense since about 1992. And if we can disentangle ourselves from this thing, it's not just based on the monetary dimension of the thing, the money that we spend, but if we can get out of these countries and stop meddling in their affairs, I think they can tend to what is in their interest. I think that's particularly true for Germany. The Germans have lived in a permanent sort of Stockholm syndrome. They've got to get out of that, and they've got to determine their own future, their own interests. If we get out, that will happen. If we linger and stay, it will delay it, and ultimately we'll be run out. I think that stands an excellent chance of happening in Japan and Korea too, by the way. They're all ready for us to leave. They don't need us. And we need
time.
To go. Oh, yeah, absolutely. But you know, there's a big difference between gracefully leaving and ultimately being pushed out. Right. And if we keep this up, we'll be pushed out. It'll be ugly.
Doug McGregor, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate all your insights. Before we say goodbye, I'll leave you with this. Ukraine is fighting a brutal war. Its people are suffering. Their courage is real. But courage does not erase corruption. And corruption does not magically become acceptable because the West doesn't want to talk about it. If the United States continues sending billions with no oversight, no transparency, and no accountability, then what we're supporting is not democracy. It's a system of untouchables. And sooner or later, the truth comes out. The truth always comes out. Please subscribe to my Substack at John Kiriakou. Stay informed, and as always, keep asking those hard questions. I'm John Kiriakou, and thanks for watching The Whistleblowers.